And we are live. Figured I would do this stream Friday night. I sent an invitation out to some people. I know some people had some plans and all that good stuff, but I figured I would throw this up here and maybe give some thoughts and also conversate if anybody is able to join on a wonderful Friday night about how the anti-war faction of the dissident media is doing. Right now, it is interesting to say in the least. You know, I talked with Craig Posage Ardula the other day, which I thought that was a really fun conversation where we kind of discussed what was going on with the Libertarian Party and much more. And he plans to vote for Chase Oliver and I'm not, which is interesting. But like I said, I threw a bunch of invites out there and I know everybody's busy. So we'll kind of see what happens. I know there's one person that was planning on showing up, though. He might be a little bit busy right now. So, you know, maybe I'll cut a little bit shorter. You know, if he decides to drop by, then we'll kind of see what happens. And some other people have invitations, but they're open to join at any time. So, yeah, I figured I would just talk about the anti-war stuff and kind of everything that's been going on lately, because it seems like this is almost getting put behind, if you will. So make sure you hit all the links below to figure out where I am, what I got going on. I'm going to be on vacation all next week, so you will not see me on Twitter as much. Thank God. Everybody's kind of at each other's throats over political stuff, now red pill stuff too, which, you know, neither here nor there. I don't have a dog in the fight. I like everybody involved, but let's just say Ryan had said iron sharpens iron, and I definitely think some of the iron was sharper than other iron. So I don't know. I'll keep it pretty chill, but I got three podcasts coming at you guys next week, about a total of 4 hours worth of content, which I'm kind of stoked that I got that much for you guys. And all good with it. So you guys will have a lot to watch while I'm gone. One on Monday, one on Wednesday, and one on Friday, which if you are a channel member, you could view all those podcasts right now with no ads. I don't think I even put intros in them. So they're pretty much just straightforward right to the meat of the content. I'm going to get rid of those as soon as the regular ones air. So yeah, feel free to join and become a member of the channel for $2.99 a month, which I think is very, very cheap. And once again, it's just made as a kind of put your foot in the door and an affordable way to support me if that's what you want to do. So I think that's that. I kind of drug this intro out a little bit. And hello, Conrad. Hopefully you're doing well, man. Make sure you hit all the links below to figure out where I am, what I got going on. And like I said, you should become a channel member for $2.99 a month to view all the podcasts and, you know, to support me if you so choose. Tiger Fitness, Deemed Fit, and Fox & Sons Coffee. Use code Kyle at checkout at Fox & Sons. Tiger Fitness through the link below and Deemed Fit through the link below using code Sarah Matovic at checkout to let them know that the Matovic family sent you there. So without further ado, I guess we'll just kind of rock and roll here and see what happens.
Power up fall projects with Ego at Lowe's. Every tool delivers power beyond belief. So whether it's leaves, limbs, or lawn cleanup, count on Ego to deliver the power, performance, and innovation you need. And now for a limited time, save up to $60 on select blowers, chainsaws, and pole saws. Shop Ego today at Lowe's. Offers valid through 10-1 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
And welcome back, everybody. Second or third podcast for the week. I don't know. I don't even keep track. I just know normally Wednesdays are the night that I do them. So yeah, I figured I'd throw this together. I normally try to have a couple people join with me. I threw it out there and it seemed like we had a few people that were coming together, but some other stuff came up. So, you know, it kind of is what it is. I'll get it figured out one of these days. The first one I did was episode 54, 55. With Kyle Anzalone, Connor Freeman, and Patrick McFarlane. It's a really cool show. And we did it one more time, I want to say back in June. Enjoyed that. Those are really, really fun chats. And the first time I talked to those guys, I had to go back and listen to it again because those guys are just a wealth of knowledge that I'm not in a lot of these respects. As much as I like to talk about foreign policy, I obviously leave it up to people who are much, much more smarter than me to do the deep digging and stuff like that. And then I like to, you know, throw metaphorical bombs on Twitter. So, you know, a big goal of this podcast over the last 3 years that I've been doing it, Jesus, I can't believe that, has been to focus on foreign policy and health and fitness related topics. The podcasts I'm dropping next week, one was more political and maybe even metaphysical, if you will. The second one was definitely political with Jacob Johnson, which you can go see that on his channel, but I'm just re-airing it on my show because I feel like we had a pretty good conversation that covered a lot of stuff that I think he invited me on to talk about and stuff that he wanted to talk about. And I was just kind of there for it. So I figured it was a good enough show to reshare for everybody. So that'll be Wednesday. And then Friday's going to be a more health oriented show, which I kind of need to get back to sharing some more of that and sharing some more information about the health world. Although it's pretty one dimensional. I mean, there's only so many ways I could tell you guys to eat sufficient protein, get some physical activity in, and just don't overeat. Right. And sleep correctly. That's it. Sorry. There's only so many ways I can tell you guys to do that and kind of reveal new stuff. So I don't know, maybe I could try and rewrite the wheel, if you will, as in, you know, try to rehash some of the old material. But I feel like I've done a pretty good job with the earlier podcast, but I don't know. I gain new listeners and maybe they would enjoy the perspective. But I wanted to do this stream again to kind of talk about anti-war stuff. It's interesting because it seems like people talk a lot about foreign policy in our current election, but it's not really focused on as much, or at least not in any serious capacity, where people are more looking at like a shallow level, more of like the rhetoric, which candidate has better rhetoric on foreign policy. And not that that's insignificant and doesn't matter. But when you actually get to the kind of meat of everything and you start talking about what Trump's foreign policy or Kamala Harris's, Joe Biden's foreign policy look like in effect, it becomes pretty clear, at least where I stand, that I hate to say it, I don't support either one. I was talking to a boomer coworker today and he was all worried up saying that the Chinese and the Iranians are going to come and invade America. And it's like, all right, man. Okay. I think you're nuts because either one of those countries just have no capability or no desire to really invade America, because I think they know that if they were to F around, then they would find out, as the, you know, as we all kind of say nowadays. And just on a complete and total side tangent, I was listening to Bleeding Through. I think the song was called Our Brand is Chaos. And there's like a whole economy now of people just saying F around and find out, which I think is just hilarious. So, hey, Siege, good to see you, man. I think it was towards the end of the song where they said something about F around and find out. And there's a song by Bad Wolves called Knife where they say the same thing throughout the song. And it's kind of funny, but to the point, I don't think the Iranians or the Chinese are going to be on American shores. Blake Masters had threw that out there when he was being interviewed by Dave Smith that what are we going to do when the Chinese storm the beaches of California? And it's like, you really think we don't have like the capabilities to take care of those people if they were to do that, and how ridiculous that sounds. There was War Games done by Lyle Goldstein, and this kind of goes the other way, but War Games mapped out by Lyle Goldstein when he was on Scott Horton's show. And I mean, obviously this wasn't like done on Scott's show, but Lyle Goldstein is kind of like the, he does a lot of these war games and kind of maps out the way that some stuff would play foreign policy wise. And one of the things that he said is that if we were, as in the U.S. were to go to war with China, then we would lose 3,000 troops within the first month or something like that. And if you think that wouldn't escalate drastically, I think you're a little out of your mind. Dickie, good to see you. I'll be down in, well, your former neck of the woods now, which is unfortunate. I'm an aspiring Florida man, but unfortunately, I'm just not, it's not realistic. You know better than me, Dickie. It is tough to live down there. It's hot and it is not cheap. It is not cheap at all. When we talk about those war games, I mean, it poses a serious threat to the world, really. And that's why I like to talk about this stuff so much. And like the grand scheme of things, am I personally going to move the needle very much? I don't know, probably not. But, you know, hopefully I can kind of put it in people's consciousness. There we go. Yeah, that's the right word. I could put this kind of stuff into people's conscious and bring enough people together to maybe shift the conversation somewhere, some way, somehow, and maybe it ends up in somebody important's ear. And I think that's kind of what our hope is when we're doing this whole kind of podcasting deal. The endorsement of Masters by Dr. Paul, Mr. McAdams, Dave Smith was a very rare L for them. It was hard to disagree with them. Yeah, I think it's because the marketing around Blake Masters, right? Where he was marketed as like a former libertarian anarchist who had read all the books and did all this stuff. And I got just the guy with me today to talk about Blake Masters. Nice. I was a little concerned that this was that he'd come, but welcoming to the stream, my dear friend Connor Freeman. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, brother. How you doing?
Good, good, good. I'm glad you're able to join me. I was a little concerned, so I was kind of rambling here. And I don't know if you know, you retweeted it. That's right. I went to my old job today, and God bless this guy that I used to work with, but he was freaking out about how I have to vote for Donald Trump. And I understand all those guys are super big Trump supporters. I have no problem with that. But he said, you know, the Chinese and the Iranians are coming. I'm like, and then that kind of led to the necessary thought about Blake Masters.
Yeah.
Everything we got going on, you know, over the last like year and a half. So I know that's a little bit of a dialogue, but yeah, man, take it wherever you want.
Oh, Blake. Oh man. I
think you're, you might be on the wrong mic. It sounds like you're coming from your camera mic. Sorry to interrupt. But yeah.
Oh, you're good. You're good. Let me see if I can fix that.
Yeah. The whole situation with Blake.
How am I coming through now?
It still sounds like you're coming through the camera.
No. I'm sure you're right. I got to figure out how to fix this.
Yeah, you're right. And I know, I don't think we really talked about the whole Trump endorsement on air, you know, as much as you want to. You know, I don't know where I know. I think you and I are on the same page when it comes to this. I can't wait to be on a sub in the South China Sea. Hey, you know, it might be pretty nice over there because there are some parts of China that are straight up desert. So, you know, I would love to, you know, ride the waves in Belize. When I had a Carl Zaw on, him and I talked about that, and he's like, "Yeah, man, I like being in Belize for the beaches and stuff like that." And the more I thought about it, I'm like, "Oh man, that just sounds pretty nice." If I'm gonna go anywhere outside of America, China might be the place to go, man. China or like East Asia.
Do I sound all right now?
Yeah, you sound a little bit more clear.
Okay. I'm not sure. I honestly, it's, I'm not sure how, like what I'm doing wrong. Let me see.
You don't get to surface in any nice areas. Yeah, I would imagine, especially if it's wartime. I don't think they're taking you there to go drink some Japanese old fashions on the beach, or I guess it would be Chinese old fashions. All right, yeah, I don't think they're going to send you anywhere like that. War pig Dickie here. Yeah, you know what? I've been meaning to go to an AI image generator, and Dickie, what I want to do is get a picture of me, and since I'm bald now with like a wicked beard and a Hawaiian shirt and short shorts, get me riding a shark with a gun. He sounds good on my end. Okay.
Oh, I do? Okay, cool.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, go ahead. Sound off Blake Masters and then our latest kind of Libertarian Party stuff. I threw the link to Missy. She said she may or may not be able to join, so we'll kind of see what happens. Worst comes to worst, it'll just be you and I shooting the shit, which I'm good with.
Cool. So, yeah, man. I mean, Blake Masters. So Blake ran for Congress out here in Arizona again in this primary earlier. I don't even know. Man, there's so much happening that I can't even keep track. But I guess it was a month or two ago that I danced on his grave the morning he lost. You know, I had so much fun with that. I relished it. I told him, listen, look, the Senate thing didn't work. And then you try for Congress. And fortunately, that fell through. Maybe city council is where your services are needed. And maybe that's a realistic goal. Blake's biggest problem really is kind of the same thing with J.D. Vance is that, you know, I mean, really, it gets to the heart of the hypocrisy of the whole Trump phenomenon, which is essentially that, you know, they market themselves as America first, when in fact they're Israel first. And you can't reconcile those two things. So Blake was, and actually I realized some of this later on after we had done so much work covering him and what a fraud he was. on this show in particular. But, you know, there's some interviews with him when he was campaigning for Senate with the Jerusalem Post, where he's just so gung-ho on Israel. I mean, just like praising the Iron Dome, and Israel lives in a tough neighborhood and we can learn a lot from them. And just so, I mean, he's so against the Iran deal. You know, he was for sanctions on Russia even during the Ukraine war. He just disputed the rate at which they had been imposed. And he even said that on the Ron Paul Liberty Report, which is like just stupid, really, from any kind of a political.
I mean, it's like being on being in your home neighborhood and like shooting up the place or something like that. Like, what the hell are you doing, man? These are like your mentors. Like, you know, Ron Paul would never call for that. So what the hell are you doing? And I think it's because, you know, hey, we have to kind of pander to the hawks, right? And this is kind of gets to the crux of the issue. I wish I kind of would have sent a invite out to Robbie Martin or made him aware of it, because I know he's been talking about this a lot. The whole revisionist history when it comes to Trump and the neoconservatives, because I think there's been such a whitewashing campaign with Trump and the neoconservatives, where even some people in our camp kind of play this angle where they say, oh, the neocon, it's Trump versus the neocons. It's like, no. There's like two neocons that really don't like Trump, and the rest of them fell right in line behind them. And people that makes people uncomfortable, because then you have to realize that Trump ain't your guy. And that's, it's amazing how uncomfortable that is for people. I mean, you would think after, you know, him being in politics for 8 years and saying, I'm not your guy, would tell you he's not your guy, but yeah, what the hell?
Well, I, on the one hand, I empathize with people who cling to fanciful narratives about Trump.
Sure.
Because I know what it feels like to not have any representation in Congress or the Senate, let alone the executive branch. Yeah. And that's hard for people to accept, especially hard for conservatives and people who are on the right, that grew up on the right, and, you know, they really don't see any alternative. They just, they thought, they put all these kinds of hopes and expectations into Trump, and he doesn't come through on them.
Right.
I mean, he stabbed his own people in the back so hard. I mean, he poisoned his own supporters and then deprived them of legal recourse with the vaccine and Operation Warp Speed, which is like, and also, you know, just that $6 trillion bill, the CARES Act, and then praising it. And he's refused. Like, even Megyn Kelly confronted him about it last year, I think, in that interview about, you know, this vaccine has really hurt people and made them sick. And you gave the pharma companies legal immunity. And, you know, what do you say about that? He just sidestepped the issue and goes, well, you know, the Democrats say that it was great, that my Operation Warp Speed.
Yeah. And like, that's the most shocking part. It's like, the Democrats, from your perspective, are your fucking enemy, man. So why are you trying to praise them or talk about how much they love you? Like, that, in my mind, that would be so far out of step with your base. But I hate to say this, but, you know, people think that, like, the Trump base is acting rationally in this world of politics, but really it's just Trump is their guy. And really, I think if it was any other figure, if people think there's a blind loyalty to Trump, I think it's more so that the Democrats are so bad that they feel compelled to Trump. And Trump really puts on a great kayfabe, but at the end of the day, what's he always do? Caves. And this is something that you could elucidate upon a little bit more, but like, every single time where he would brag about all the troops that he brought out, typically they were the troops that he sent in, and every single theater of war he escalated. And this is something that really doesn't get talked about when it comes to Trump's foreign policy. Like, oh, well, he was such a dove, you know, there were no new wars. And what people
sometimes
say
they say there were no wars.
Yeah, people sincerely believe it too. I'm like, yeah, what?
No, yeah, you're absolutely right. So he sent the ground troops into Somalia, and then he relocated them to Djibouti in Kenya before he left, and then Biden sent them back in. Really fantastic stuff. He set records for the number of bombs he dropped in Somalia. Yep. And same deal with Yemen. Same goes for Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. You know, he set records for the number of bombs dropped in Afghanistan between 2018 and 2019. It was something like over 15 or 16,000 bombs dropped just in those 2 years. You know, obviously carried out the genocide in Yemen for 4 years, funded Kiev's war in the Donbass, vastly expanded the Asia pivot, picking up where Obama left off, particularly during 2020, under the cover of COVID, where they were just sending dual carriers into the South China Sea and carrying out these massive drills. You know, and trying to really boost the Quad into the East Asian NATO. You know, same kind of things that Biden did, really. And when he came, when Biden came into office, he took all of Trump's policies that in many cases, you know, if you're talking about Iran, if you're talking about China, if you're talking about Russia, especially, Trump was much worse than Obama. And Obama is a mass murdering son of a bitch who should be in prison.
Well, and like the one thing that people always bring up too is that you know, Trump would be so much better on Russia, but it's like he's gone on this, his whole campaign. It's so bizarre to me because I feel like I'm watching a completely different movie, and everybody's like, they're acting like it's 2016 all over again. Trump's an unknown player, but he's well known. And then he had, you know, years to kind of set things straight with Russia, but he's basically, his entire campaign, he's bragged about how hard he was on Russia. And it's like, so why do we think this dude's going to make peace with Russia when his whole deal is, look how tough I was on Russia? And this goes back to this whole stupid fucking talking point of peace through strength. Well, it seems like what peace through strength is we bomb the ever-living fuck out of you and apply every single military or sometimes non-military action on you until you comply, which I don't think is a great way to go around the world if you're trying to make friends, so to speak. If you want to make enemies, okay, well, we've done a great job of that, but you know, Trump's supposed to be the king of the deal. What the fuck are we doing?
Oh, this is fucking great. So, okay, there's an article in Foreign Policy about Trump's foreign, his like cabal of advisors that are, you know, expected to be in the administration, right? Mm. And so they go through, it's a list of them, and they tell you their background and what their views are on contemporary foreign policy issues. Mm. And so they talk about the deal he's getting ready to present, or at least that has been drawn up by General Keith Kellogg, who's a lunatic, and Fred Fleitz, who is John Bolton's longtime right-hand man, who is the vice chairman of the America First Policy Institute. You remember Michael Tracy wrote that great piece a couple of years ago about that, and how hawkish they were on Ukraine at that event they held. It's supposed to be like his PNAC, basically, like, you know, putting all the, together all the experts to take over next time he's in office. Mm-hmm. And so here's their plan. It's great. Basically, they tell Zelensky, we're going to cut your aid if you don't go to the negotiating table. And then they tell Putin, if you don't go to the negotiating table, we're going to just open the floodgates on military aid to Ukraine and really escalate the war. I mean, that is, we're not in a position to do, that's what we've been, the Biden administration has been trying to do this whole time. I mean, they don't want negotiations. Trump says he wants negotiations. That's not a good way to negotiate with Putin when he has the upper hand to such an extent here in this war. I mean, you know, I mean, the invasion of Kursk is such a desperate move. And they were attempting to draw away forces from the Donbass, which they, the Russians never did. They
this just was more recent, wasn't it?
The absolutely.
Okay, yeah. And, I've been a lot of loop with it, so.
They're, you know, set to take this town, Provost, which is, you know, very critical on the Ukrainian line there in the Donbass. And it's going to open up an opportunity for the Russians to seize vastly more territory than they have in the Donbass up to this point. And really, this Kursk invasion seems like an attempt by Zelensky to be in a position to lobby Washington into greenlighting these long range strikes, which are not going to make much of a difference on the battlefield for the sake of the Ukrainian war for those provinces. However, what it will do, and this is really the goal, and it's more and more acknowledged by analysts, whether they're in our part of the, you know, media landscape or even in the mainstream press. I mean, and even Biden apparently is concerned about this. I mean, it was in the David Sanger piece that came out recently about why he didn't really make an announcement on this past Friday, whether or not he was going to give the approval. I don't think they're going to. It sounds like the Pentagon has told them we cannot do this. I think they probably got some very strong warnings behind the scenes from the Russians, or at least that's what the Russians are saying. And, you know, Lloyd Austin, our defense chief, has been on the line with his Russian counterpart in, earlier this year. And I think that maybe a call was made. But, you know, Biden knows that the strategy is to drag NATO directly into the war. I mean, why else would we give attackums to Russia to launch attacks 200 miles into Russia when they've already been carrying out drone strikes now hundreds of miles into the Russian mainland since at least December of 2022? And at that time, I wrote an article called Washington Erases Red Lines in War with Russia, which is basically what we've done up to this point. Like in most mainstream articles that you read in the mainstream press about this, in the corporate press about this policy debate, they always come back with, oh, we've crossed so many red lines of Putin thus far. He's not going to do anything, right. We don't think. And
well, it's other people have pointed out the dichotomy here is that Putin is a madman who's going to move to reconstitute the Soviet Union, but he also will not use nukes. It's like, I'm not sure you could square that circle.
And really, I mean, that's all Zelensky can do at this point. And they're desperate. They're almost out of the aid that they pledged back in April. You know, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of men who have died in the Ukrainian military. I mean, it wasn't long ago that it was written up in Time magazine, that long profile about Zelensky, that the average age of a Ukrainian soldier is now about 43.
Right.
And no, the former interior minister said that they've taken 500,000 casualties. Of either these men have been killed, these conscripts have been killed, or they've been so gravely injured that they can't return to the battlefield. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really the thing I'm most concerned about with Trump, and you saw it in the debate when he accused, you know, he's so confused. He said, you know, Kamala, you met with Putin a few days before the war started. You met with Zelensky. You were supposed to broker a truce and make a deal, and you failed because you're weak. And then the war started. Well, really what happened was she never met with Putin. To my knowledge, she never has met Putin. What actually happened was shortly before the war began in February, Kamala was at the Munich Security Conference, and so was Zelensky. And Zelensky gave a speech there where he hinted that Ukraine may abandon all the principles of the Budapest Memorandum from 1994 and that they may seek nuclear weapons. And that was a major provocation, and it wasn't denounced or criticized by Harris at all. And so, you know, the war started. I'm not saying that was what tipped the scales that led to the invasion, but that's the real story of what happened at the Munich Security Conference. And his whole point of view, really, and that of his advisors, which is terrifying, is that the Biden administration has been too weak on the world stage, and that's the inherent problem with their foreign policy. Mm-hmm. When in fact, he's been so much more hawkish than Trump when it comes to Iran, especially China, and Russia. And Trump dwarfed Obama's policies regarding Russia. I mean, really, the pattern that we're seeing and the trajectory that we're on is really they've taken the principles of the defense planning guidance that Paul Wolfowitz, arch neocon, wrote up in February of 1992, which is, okay, the Cold War is over. We have the unipolar moment, as Charles Krauthammer described it back then. And our primary objective now is to prevent the emergence or reemergence of any near peer competitor and any, you know, Russia, China, Germany, Japan. They are never to have a larger global or regional role. We have to make sure we can basically destroy them if we have to. Right. And what that is manifested into is what you saw in the the National Defense Strategy from 2022 and the one from 2018, where consistently they'll tell you that the two main enemies are Russia and China. China is really the number one enemy. And right. Every branch of the military is preparing for a hot war with China, a direct war beyond what we've done with Russia. It's not going to be the kind of proxy war situation vis-a-vis Taiwan that we've seen in Ukraine. They're talking about, I mean, hell, the chief of the Navy this week, and Dave DeCamp, the story wrote up about it, is up at antiwar.com right now. She mm-hmm. just released a plan for how we're going to be prepared and ready to go to war at a moment's notice with China by 2027. And it's all based on lies about how President Xi said that, oh, I'm going to invade Taiwan in 2027. And that claim originated with a former head of Indo-Pacific Command, Phil Davidson. Back in 2021. And, you know, the whole fucking Asia pivot is really kind of like a public works project for the Navy, the military industrial complex, and shipbuilders. I mean, it's based really in the ideology of neoconservatism and their liberal analogs in the Democratic foreign policy blob. But it really does come down to, at the end of the day, money. I mean, the same deal with the nuclear weapons industrial complex. You know, we're, and man, that is another thing that's so terrifying. Michael Clare wrote this piece recently that was at Tom Dispatch. We reran it at antiwar.com, and it will scare the life out of you because, you know, New START is due to expire in 2026. And currently the US and Russia are no longer a part of it because of the war in Ukraine. And this limits the number of strategically deployed nuclear warheads that both countries have. And so it's going to expire in 2026. So that means that Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have, you know, really less than a year to come up with a solution to this. Now, are they going to reduce their nuclear arsenals and, you know, make a deal with the other side so that they follow suit? Most likely not. I mean, that would be impossible to pull off politically in the United States right now. And or are they going to continue with Obama's plan of modernizing, really expanding our nuclear arsenal and breaking free from the limits of New START? And really, I mean, the idea that we are our fate with this, as he calls it, Armageddon agenda is being put in the hands of either Kamala Harris or Donald Trump is just terrifying. And we are on the brink of war with Russia right now. And we're inching closer and closer to the day where we start firing shots and dropping bombs and going after the Chinese in earnest, which is a foregone conclusion from basically every branch of the military, all these top officials. I mean, Kirk Campbell, the architect of the Asia pivot, replaced Victoria Nuland. He's number two at the State Department now. And he's hyping it up that this is the greatest fight our country has ever seen.
Well, and the thing that a lot of people are missing out on here, and it's because Kamala Harris is so vapid and just nothing, you know. I think what people are missing here is that her foreign policy is going to be copy paste Joe Biden, which is escalation everywhere, no negotiations, and continue to ramp up tensions with everyone without any diplomacy whatsoever. And, you know, people, I think I told you I had a conversation, and the conversation is up on Cognitive Vigilance's channel, where we kind of talked about some of the foreign policy stuff. And it's so amazing to me that, like, even some libertarians are ignorant of the pivot to Asia. And when you show them the national defense strategies, they're like, huh? And it's like, well, you guys got to be, like, up to par with this. Like, this is the issue. And, you know, I talked to Craig Pasajardula the other day, and I mentioned to him how you and I did a podcast about, it was probably a year and a half ago now, around when RFK first started running. And we were glowing with praise for him because he was the only one willing to say, you know what, how about we, like, don't fight a war with China? And it's like, wow, that's like not a big deal. Like, that's not, I don't think that's a big ask, but he was the only candidate saying it. And then literally like the day after is just when he went on this full unhinged Zionist rampage. So
in retrospect, that's one of the most embarrassing moments of my career is fucking going to bat for him, write an article.
We tried, yeah. Man. We wanted to have hope. And I mean, it's kind of like the Donald Trump situation where people have hope. But basically, the main point is that I think a lot of people are underestimating how bad Kamala Harris is. And obviously, Donald Trump, too. And we've kind of tackled that quite a bit. But like the Kamala Harris campaign or the Kamala Harris foreign policy is going to be the same deal. Lloyd Austin, Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken, all at the helm. And like you said, Kirk Campbell as well, who are going to be kind of steering the ship. And it's not like Trump has doves either. But you know, Anthony Blinken has really been, the architect of everything that we're kind of seeing now, where he's saying, you know, we're going to fight a war with China. And that's the interest of the State Department at this point. And I don't think Trump's State Department is going to be any different. But I just think people downplay the fact that Kamala Harris is, you know, she's pretty much bought off by Israel, too. She's received a whole ton of money from AIPAC, her husband. People joke as her AIPAC handler. She supposedly, the rumor was that she couldn't pick Josh Shapiro because he's Jewish. It's like, no, you guys are retards. Like, you could find, if you really type in Kamala Harris AIPAC, you will find her speech, a half hour speech in front of an AIPAC assembly in 2017. It's not like she's some, like, you know, pro-Palestinian agent or as Trump calls everybody now, a Palestinian who the hell is it? Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer is like in the top 10 recipients of AIPAC aid, and he's a Palestinian. Joe Biden's a Palestinian who's received more AIPAC aid than any candidate ever. Like, these are Palestinians. What are we talking about?
Yeah, and I'll point out, because a lot of Trump people cling to this idea. You remember there was this controversy that Netanyahu called Biden shortly after the election result, you know, the election took place, and congratulated him on his victory. And they were all like, Trump was so pissed about that. And Trump was pissed that Netanyahu wasn't looking for a peace deal after he met Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, who's the head of the PA in the West Bank. And he said, you know, he was a great man. And I was struck because, you know, clearly Netanyahu is the one who doesn't want to make a deal. Well, the reason he's going after Chuck Schumer is not because Chuck Schumer objects to the Israeli war on Gaza, the genocide, the Holocaust that we're all co-bylining. I shouldn't say we're all, our government is, but it implicates us, just like the wars that we support, or Israel's wars and occupations we've supported for decades before the attacks on 9/11, and that were largely motivated the key hijackers in that attack. And so I can never forgive anybody that's a pro-Israel politician to this day, because it's just, you know, just they may as well do what the Israelis do and bulldoze some cemeteries and dig up the victims of 9/11 and just desecrate their bodies. But, you know, Schumer gave that speech in the beginning of the year, where he said, and he's right, actually, that Netanyahu is taking Israel down the path. I mean, they already have. It's kind of ridiculous for him to say, like, we're at risk of this, but of Israel becoming a pariah state. And and he blamed largely his alliance and his coalition with Itamar Ben-Gvir, the head of the Jewish Power Party, who's the national security minister, as well as Bezalel Smotrich, who's the finance minister and the de facto occupation governor of the West Bank, given this position he has in the defense ministry. And that's why Trump is attacking him. Not because Schumer is like against the war, or he's calling to condition aid to Israel, or anything. Schumer's always been one of the most pro-Israel senators in the history of the country. In fact, you know, there's I forget what the summit was, one of these big Israel lobby summits. And Haim Saban, who's this billionaire oligarch, single issue guy, he's effectively the Democratic Party's analog to Sheldon Adelson or Miriam Adelson. Okay. And he's sitting on this panel with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And Nancy Pelosi says, and this is before January 6th, she said, if the entire Capitol burned down tonight, the thing that would be left standing in the morning would be our commitment to our aid to Israel. She goes, and I don't even call it aid. I call it cooperation to the state of Israel. And then Chuck Schumer sits there and goes, and the whole crowd erupts in applause. So that's the way these people think. And, you know, Pelosi, same deal, man. She didn't go to she condemned Netanyahu's speech to Congress, the State of the Union, where he received, 60 standing ovations in a 58-minute speech or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she condemned that. She said it was, you know, one of the worst things. We shouldn't have had him do this.
Yeah, Carter, it sounds like we got Israel derangement syndrome. At least that's what I'm told by our greatest ally.
Yeah, by Tim.
So, oh, hold on one sec.
Sure.
Connerell, speaking of Al-Qaeda, Hamza bin Laden, son of Osama, is alive. Speaking of Al-Qaeda planning something, any thoughts on this? Real quick, let me give you a video for your super chat.
Falcon Punch!
I love that video. That's a sneaker getting punched in the face by a
sneaker. Well, you know, speaking of the Al-Qaeda risks, I predict that there's going to be major attacks. You know, really, one of the reasons why I'm a little bit surprised that there hasn't been yet, or not, I shouldn't say, I'm the reason I'm not surprised that there hasn't been attacks yet, is that really, in the last several years, it's, first of all, Israel has been a major benefactor to Al-Qaeda, particularly in Syria. Mm-hmm. And Israel's never been attacked by Al-Qaeda. The one time there were some skirmishes between ISIS and the IDF near the border with the Golan Heights, where ISIS was effectively imposing a buffer zone for Israel. And, you know, there's a lot of reports you can go back and look at during the war in Syria where the Israelis were flying as Al-Qaeda and ISIS's air force against Hezbollah and the Syrian Arab Army, for instance. The one time that there were skirmishes between ISIS and the IDF, ISIS issued an apology. So I'm not surprised that there haven't been attacks on Israel. What I do expect is for there to be massive. And by the way, I don't mean that that can never happen. It's just, I'm not surprised it hasn't yet. Avril Haines warned recently that there's going to be Al-Qaeda attacks on Israel. And I kind of rolled my eyes, but she also said that the U.S. is at risk. And I don't doubt that at all. I mean, this idea that Hezbollah and Hamas are coming over the border and they're going to attack us here, I don't think that's as likely. It's not impossible, but they really are focused on their regional issues. I mean, really, Hezbollah rose in opposition to the almost 20-year occupation of southern Lebanon that Israel began with its invasion in 1982. And they carried out some of the worst terrorist attacks in history against the Lebanese. And Hezbollah rose up in opposition to that. That's who they are. Hezbollah's enemies are Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Israel, and now the United States. And the precursors of Hezbollah did blow up the Marine barracks in Beirut. But that was an illegal occupation. And that's the kind of thing that the American revolutionaries would have done. And I'm not justifying, I'm saying that we haven't been attacked by them since. We haven't been attacked by Iran since. So these kinds of arguments that, Israel's enemies are our enemies, that's simply not true. Our enemies if you can say we have any enemies, they would be Al-Qaeda. I think there's a very good argument that Israel is our enemy as well. But I am very concerned. And I have a piece coming out about this recently, sort of attacking the right from the right in the America First, the so-called America First movement, about how our support for Israel and its serial slaughter and, like I said, underwriting and facilitating this genocide, this Holocaust, is going to cause major terrorist attacks. And we're going to see the American people murdered once again, just like they were on 9/11 and in subsequent terrorist attacks against American civilians since, because of what the U.S. is doing in the region. It's always the same story. It's blowback for our foreign policy, despite what Tim Pool might say about how crazy radical Islam or whatever.
They did, in fact, hate us for our blue jeans and freedom.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, I'm very concerned. I think that they have a great recruiting pitch now. The question is, and there's been a debate about this for a long time within Al-Qaeda, is, Ayman al-Zawahiri and bin Laden were very ideological and believe that basically, we need to overthrow the dictatorships that the U.S. supports in our neighborhood, in our home countries. Many of them were tortured. Like, for instance, Zawahiri was tortured by the Mubarak regime in Egypt. And that's one of the things that motivated him to join up the jihad. And they need to overthrow those dictators so they can build their Islamic state. But they also want to, liberate Jerusalem. And God knows what they would do to it after, if they ever did. But their policy essentially is that the American, the far enemy, the empire that underwrites these regimes, including Israel, has to be pushed out of the region first. Hence the 9/11 attacks and the series of attacks on American targets throughout the 1990s. They were attempting to bait us into Afghanistan and a wider war in the region, if possible, which obviously we fell right into that trap. And it was really the neocons' goal. I mean, they understand, bin Laden understood who the neoconservatives are. And so, we completely have bankrupted ourselves. We've killed somewhere between 4 and 5 million people through direct violence or indirect violence in the post 9/11 wars alone. I think that this war that Israel is dragging us into with Hezbollah and then Iran, which also means, and I pointed this out on Twitter today because of the I'm so sick of fucking Trump and the America First stuff. If Trump is running on this 100% loyalty to Israel pledge, which he is, what that really means is, because what David Friedman, his former ambassador to Israel, is talking about now, he just put out a book about this. He wants the U.S. to fund the full ethnic cleansing, a final Nakba of the West Bank, so that they can de jure annex it. And they're going to do, greater Israel, they're going to try and seize land in southern Lebanon as well. And who knows where else. If we get behind this and want to finish the job, as he talks about in Gaza, it's going to lead to this. They're already starting this war with Hezbollah. We're going to be dragged into a war with Iran in all likelihood. That also means escalating the wars in Yemen against the Houthis for their naval blockade against Israeli shipping and now U.S. And British vessels and naval ships. Because they've been launching hundreds of strikes on Yemen since January. And it also means re-escalating the war in Syria, where they've already killed 500,000 people with their dirty war, and we illegally occupy a third of the country and impose some of the worst sanctions in history on the Syrian people. 90% of that country lives below the poverty line, and we're stealing their oil and their wheat. And Americans are sitting there in these illegal occupation bases, sitting ducks, because Israel, and we can look at this from the stories from the Trump campaign and Israeli media, and you can look at, as well as, you know, when, what's his name? The Israeli prime minister, who was in August of 2021, who told Biden, my plan is to destroy Iran, death by a thousand cuts, covert, military, economic, diplomatic, and you must maintain your permanent presence in Iraq and in Syria to check Iran. And we've done that ever since. I mean, there was no dispute about that with Biden. And so, yes, I mean, there's so many targets for Americans to be hit just in that region. If you're talking about the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar or the Fifth Fleet based in Bahrain, and plus you have thousands and thousands of troops spread all over those countries. So, and I expect American cities to be attacked too. And really it's because this, what we're doing right now is so much worse than what we were doing before 9/11. This is, we are actually, the American people now, because of our government, and there's no debate about this, we among the either major party, we are in the process of exterminating the Palestinians. And we're ethnically cleansing historic Palestine for Israel, because that land is coveted by the Israeli settler movement. These are Muslims and Christians, and we're murdering them every day in mass. And that should be absurd. It should be the kind of thing that somebody writes in a novel that's like some dystopian sort of thing. But that's what we're doing. And so there's no way we can get out of this unscathed without massive increases in terrorist attacks in the United States. I don't see any way around that.
Yeah, man. And I mean, it really, and this is why I think like focusing on migration as or to the exclusion of foreign policy is a failed venture, at least in my opinion. And I have friends who would disagree with me on this. I think that when you, that the foreign policy really does incentivize people to come here, because once again, we're destroying their homeland. So why would you stay? And they do make the argument that, hey, they're coming from some countries that we're not like for, you know, we're not really intervening in. But I think that's a pretty weak argument, especially when you consider like all the Venezuelans. And then if we're really worried about Hamas or these other people coming across the border, okay, well, why don't we just leave them alone? They don't hate us because they hate America. They hate us because we continually, as you've mentioned throughout the show, kind of fund Israel. There is one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I don't think I covered it on Wednesday show with Pasta. What the hell was going on with the pagers? I threw up that one picture of the, you know, the rubbing the hands on the pager, which was, it's pretty funny, but what the hell was going on there, man? And like, you know, we have our Tim Cass libertarians who are celebrating it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I saw Michael Malice doing his usual anarchist for Zionism shtick.
Yeah, anarcho-Zionism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before I forget, the prime minister I was thinking of was Naftali Bennett. Israel's had five elections in 4 years because their government is so destabilized, because their country is a complete mess. Mm-hmm. So the pagers. So apparently these were purchased because Hezbollah was trying to avoid the surveillance on their cell phones. So they ordered these pagers from a company called Apollo Gold, or Gold Apollo, rather. That's based in Taiwan. Now, the company is saying that actually what they received were products that from a company based in Hungary that has a license to put their label on it or their name on it. So those were intercepted by Israeli intelligence and then implanted with explosives in a detonator switch. And then the same thing happened with the walkie-talkies, who I guess were ordered from a company apparently based in Japan. And they set them up, they blew them up, killing 37 people, wounding thousands more, including very severely. Two children have been killed, including a 9-year-old, a girl, and an 11-year-old boy. And there was, you know, multiple medical workers killed. These went off in hospitals, homes, markets, crowded streets, all kinds of civilian targets. It's an indiscriminate act of terrorism. The footage of it is absolutely brutal and disgusting. Basically, by doing this, really, it's a sign. And Nasrallah, the head of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, has acknowledged this, that this is the crossing of all red lines, that there's no going back. Basically, this means war. And the thing is, what's so crazy about this is Israel and Hezbollah have been trading fire over their border, their shared border, for 11 months now. It began on October 8th. And Hezbollah's position the entire time, Israel's launched almost 8,000 strikes on Lebanon since, killing, you know, hundreds of civilians. They bomb paramedics like all the time. It's every week or every few days, there's a story from Jason Dentz at antiwar.com. Oh, they killed more paramedics. They killed more civilians. They killed another kid. They killed another woman. And it's always based on this idea that we're attacking Hezbollah terrorist infrastructure and rocket sites and all this stuff. They're also using white phosphorus and poisoning the agriculture and poisoning people. Some of the pictures I've seen of kids poisoned with white phosphorus, like little girls, it's sick what we're actually doing. And Israel loves using white phosphorus. They've used it in Gaza as well since this latest war began, the genocide. And so, you know, Hezbollah's, they've been launching strikes primarily at military sites. I was attacking Brad Sherman, the congressman, on Twitter about this last night. He's trying to make the argument that these devices are the walkie-talkies and pagers. Those are military devices. So if you have them, you know, they're legitimate targets in a war. And so he's saying that if those were given to civilians, and those civilians are basically collateral damage, or that that's Hezbollah's fault. Somehow it's always the party that Israel is slaughtering, the only resistance group in the area where Israel is carrying out its Dahiya doctrine, of which was, you know, which they coined after the 2006 war in Lebanon, that this is, you know, where we just relentlessly and with massive force bomb civilians, men, women, and children, and all kinds of civilian infrastructure to put immense pressure on the domestic population, which is what you can see in Gaza as well.
And yeah, the Hamas, Bank. Yeah, the Hamas charter is so bad, but...
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. And so, and they've, you know, of course, rewrote that, and they've basically said that they would recognize since 2017 Israel within 1967 borders, but that's not good enough. Meaning they give up 78% of historic Palestine in exchange for their little 22% in just the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem with its capital. But Trump made sure that that can never happen when he moved the embassy to Jerusalem and recognized it as the unified capital of the state of Israel. And so Hezbollah's position with these cross-border attacks, similarly to the Houthis, has been, we will stop immediately when there is a ceasefire and a withdrawal of troops from Gaza. We can't stand by and do nothing, and we will stay in solidarity and stand in solidarity with the Palestinians there until this is done. Well, they can't do that because Netanyahu doesn't want a deal and has been thwarting it at every juncture. And this is completely admitted in Israeli media. There's no real debate about it. And, you know, the former heads of Shin Bet, which is effectively their FBI, have come out and said this. You have the IDF saying this. You have the even Mossad and people from his negotiating team admitting this. There's no question. Netanyahu lies. He says, I got to keep the Philadelphia corridor because that's where they're going to smuggle weapons. And then you have a former head of Shin Bet come out and say, they never smuggle weapons through the Philadelphia corridor. He knows he's lying. You know, this is a figment of the imagination of Benjamin Netanyahu, and he's imposing it on the public. But we always knew that that's not where they were getting their weapons. And then the IDF comes out because Netanyahu said, and there's a really interesting story about this, I think in 972 Mag that was run at antiwar.com last week, about how Netanyahu's men and the military is investigating this now. It shows you what a shit show Israel is. They fabricated stories in, outlets in the UK and Germany, where they were basically saying, you know, Israel discovered these documents in Gaza, some of them from Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas, and these other senior commanders, and they interrogated these guys and got this information that they're going to take the hostages, smuggle them through the Philadelphia corridor, which is on the Gaza-Egypt border, take them to Egypt, and then fly them to Iran. And then we'll never be able to get him back. And even Sarah Netanyahu went and met with hostages' families who were, you know, there was free after the six hostages were killed under the tunnels in the tunnels under Rafah back at the end of August, after he had launched his new war in the West Bank. they were executed, which makes sense, by the way. Hamas explained this after it happened. Now, again, I don't know if they actually killed them, but the rules have changed nonetheless. Hamas says, and this makes total sense. I'm sorry, it's very ugly logic, but it's very clear logic. Okay, so their point is, you know, when they rescued that girl, Noah Origami, who was in the IDF, they disguised themselves as aid workers, which immediately puts any aid worker in Gaza who's not already been murdered by the Israelis in, you know, puts them at risk by anybody in the strip because they can't trust them now. They dress up as aid workers. They go in special operations groups and they go in and try to rescue her. Well, in the meantime, they're dropping all these 2,000-pound bombs on a crowded marketplace, and they killed something like 200 people at the time. It was a brutal attack. And then we were all supposed to celebrate in America that Noah's rescued and she's back home now. Well, after that happened, they changed their rules of engagement vis-a-vis the hostages. So what they're saying is, okay, so you're going to prevent a ceasefire deal and a hostage release deal and for us to get our thousands of Palestinian prisoners who are locked up in these apartheid jails in Israel that you've kidnapped in the West Bank and kidnapped from Gaza that you're torturing and starving to death. Okay, so if you're not going to do that and you're not going to end the siege and you're not going to withdraw from Gaza because you're going to keep the Netrazim corridor, they've already stolen 26% of the Gaza Strip, and you're going to keep the Philadelphia corridor with this indefinite military presence, this indefinite occupation, then if you're going to try and get the hostages out through military pressure, as Netanyahu has promised to continue to do, then we're going to execute the hostages. If you get close to us and you have an opportunity to get them out by killing people here and continuing the war instead of negotiating, then we will kill them. And we're going to tell you, the families of the hostages now have to make a decision. What's more important to you? Ethnically cleansing Gaza, finishing off this Holocaust and redeeming yourselves for the disengagement policy of 2005, where they pulled the settlers and the soldiers out and the bases, and they imposed the siege shortly after in 2007, the complete siege. What's more important to you, your family members or ending this war? And they have, you know, the families there, I mean, and the families of American citizens who are still in Gaza, there, it's very clear they want a negotiation. In fact, during Netanyahu's State of the Union speech, in D.C. To Congress recently, they arrested family members of the hostages for wearing shirts that said "Seal the deal now." They were arrested for protest. I mean, and they also arrested like hundreds of Jewish anti-war protesters at the Capitol the day before. And then Netanyahu came out and said, "For all we know, these people are all funded by Iran." Some of those were family members of the hostages. But that shows you how fascist and completely bought and paid for our Congress and our whole government is that they would even do that. You'd think that that would be beyond the pale to arrest hostage family members of American citizens. So anyway, so, you know, that's what they did. And so now basically, I mean, they're just, I mean, we're in a situation now where Israel is just going to carry out the war. And they're going to attempt to finish off this genocide. And they don't care about the hostages. It's very clear. And they're not. And that's the thing. So they're not. He's not making a deal. And so Hezbollah and the Houthis are going to indefinitely continue their resistance to the war. I mean, the Houthis got off that drone strike and another strike in Tel Aviv. And so then subsequently, Israel bombed the hell out of the Hodeidah port. And this is a country that the United States, along with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, committed a genocide against from between 2015 and early 2022. So Obama's guilty of genocide. Donald Trump is guilty of genocide and siding with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, by the way, which isn't pointed out nearly enough. He did that for 4 years. Al-Qaeda and ISIS was the shock troops of the Saudi UAE coalition, the US-backed coalition. And then Joe Biden carried out some of the worst, you know, authorized and greenlighted and underwrote some of the worst bombing in the country for years when he came into office.
Yeah, and you know, he campaigned on ending the war in Yemen, and then I know it was kind of in limbo from like 2020 until the war in Gaza started, if I remember correctly. But then, like you said, he started all this bombing recently.
Well, yeah. So he had called Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince Bonesaw, a pariah on the campaign trail. But as soon as he got into office, really, it was business as usual. And a big part of this, we have to remember, it deals with Israel. So, you know, I'll never forget one of the first things that Kyle and I ever covered when I started doing conflicts of interest. Kyle Anzalone, the news editor at the Institute, he runs, he hosts the show Conflicts of Interest, which I co-host once a week. And he's the opinion editor at antiwar.com. Brilliant writer and analyst. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the first things we ever covered was, you remember there was, as a part of the Abraham Accords, we promised the UAE F-35s and 14,000 different munitions and drones. Well, that fell through because of the F-35s, because they refused to cut ties with Huawei as part of our, because a big part of the Abraham Accords is isolating China, or at least attempting to in the Middle East, which is very difficult to do because China basically just does business with everybody, including the Israelis, which the US is also not happy about, and makes peace deals. So it's obviously a much more appealing approach than Tony Blinken demanding you cut ties with a tech giant because we're in a new Cold War with China. We don't understand the multipolar world. But so, okay, so when those arms, there was a debate in the Senate. There was a debate about authorizing these arms deals because the UAE is a known human rights abuser, and they've carried out war crimes in Yemen and these kinds of things. And so there was a debate. Well, who stepped up to the plate to tell and whip Congress into green lighting these arms sales? It was the Israel lobby. And so that's a big part of the Abraham Accords. You know, this is the UAE, Bahrain. I mean, just read the State Department report on the human rights situation in Bahrain and you'll have nightmares for weeks. But anyway, so Israel, this whole policy, the reason why that didn't work out was because, you know, the goal of the Biden administration this whole time has been to ink this dream deal of a normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. They really do believe that Saudi Arabia is their key to ingratiating apartheid Israel in the broader Muslim world. They think it's that's the big prize of the Abraham Accords project that was started by the Donald Trump administration. And they've been trying, even since the genocide in Gaza started, to make that deal work. I, shortly before the war started, was frankly shocked when Mohammed bin Salman told Brett Baer on TV in that interview with Fox News that we are getting closer to this deal every day. I mean, Tom Friedman in the New York Times is practically having an orgasm in his columns about it. And he was saying, like, this is going to be the Biden foreign policy victory. We're going to isolate China and the Middle East. We're going to make peace with peace. We're going to normalize Israeli apartheid with Saudi by having this deal with Saudi Arabia. All the U.S. has to do is give it a defense commitment, the likes of which we've extended to, South Korea or Japan, provide them advanced weapon systems that they haven't received yet or allow them to buy them, and help them build a civilian nuclear energy program. And obviously that didn't work because Netanyahu went to the General Assembly meeting, held up his map of the new Middle East, and all of Palestine was erased and it was part of Greater Israel. And then Hamas launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on October 7th. And ever since then, they've been committing genocide of the Palestinians. And that's just politically, it can't work because the people of those countries, even if they're completely controlled by the U.S., their people absolutely despise what Israel is doing and what the U.S. is doing. And politically, they just can't make that work. And one of the weirdest things you hear, like, because Blinken will say, like, we're still working on it. And I think it's really close. And one of the things that they'll say is, like, they want to demand that Saudi Arabia fund the reconstruction of Gaza as part of, like, a post-war settlement. Yeah, which is incredible that they would demand that.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible to think. Do you got to run?
Mm-mm.
Okay, cool. I remember you saying that you might have been on a little bit of a time limit. So maybe we could wrap on this. We'll probably go for a little bit on this, but I definitely wanted your opinion on it. The Rescue the Republic and their latest edition of Known America First or
Charlie Kirk.
So I found the specific tweet that I wanted to find, and this is very, very telling. So once again, me, no personal issues with Angela. We're good friends, but this is who we're bringing. Okay. 6 days after October 7th. And yeah. Okay. Everybody can read this. 6 days after October 7th, I went on the PBD podcast and asked a series of questions about what Israeli intelligence failures happened that allowed Hamas to massacre 1,200 civilians. The clip went viral and I was attacked as an anti-Semite and worse than a Holocaust denier. And remember, he didn't even say anything bad about, he didn't say anything about Jewish people at all. He literally just said, what happened and how could they have failed? That very reasonable question to ask, but
I wish he left out the part where he's like, and that was just from my investors.
But now my instincts have been vindicated by a recent bombshell report proving Israel knew Hamas attack plans more than a year in advance. They called it the Jericho Wall, and the plans were shared widely with intelligence and defense officials. Now many more questions must be answered. Why did Israeli intelligence officials, when notified of unusual activity in Gaza on October 6th, and I'll put one-on-one, why did it take 6 to 20 hours? I stand with Israel and its offensive against Hamas, but the U.S. should not send one more penny until to Israel until we have answers to these questions. So this was December 1st, 2023. But what has he done ever since? Everything is about we support Israel and all this money that's going to, checks notes, Hamas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. It's really sad. Well, he should be happy because, you know, David Friedman's plan is to take $1 billion at least from any kind of aid that goes to the Palestinians and use that to fund Israel's final Nakba in the West Bank, where they're going to ethnically cleanse and genocide the Palestinians in the West Bank. And that's a huge part of the rhetoric of this new war in the West Bank. And we can get into that on another show, because the war they're carrying out in the West Bank is absolutely heinous. They're bringing, you know, there was even a Haaretz editorial recently called Israel is turning the West Bank into Gaza, because they're employing some of the same tactics. I mean, in Jenin alone, they tore up 70% of the infrastructure, the water, the sewage, the electricity. Mm-hmm. They murdered, you know, they've been murdering, I think, dozens and dozens of people in this new thing they call Operation Summer Camp. So they attack Tershom's refugee camp. It's really incredible what they've been doing. Demolishing dozens of homes, murdering children, just carrying out airstrikes on a scale we haven't seen since the Second Intifada. It's the largest attack on the West Bank since, almost 20 years ago. And they're moving toward with a full annexation, and they're just killing a massive number of people. Laying siege to hospitals.
And that seems to be something notable, is that, and I really don't see people talk about this as much as I think they should, that Israel has really gone on a campaign of just leveling, not just like a bomb, leveling hospitals, churches, schools. Real quick, I found this video and I'm curious what the, this is our guy who's going to help us save the Republic. Of course, there's a website, TPSA stands with Israel. Okay, let me make sure I get our cameras and everything right. Yeah, that should be good. All right.
America.
What evidence?
He asked that, the guy asked, why is Israel so important to America?
Do you have that the Bible is true?
Well, we have archaeological.
Right, where is that archaeological evidence found?
In Israel.
Right. I love this shit.
This is controlled by Muslims. Are we able to access that archaeological evidence?
No.
So therefore, as it's controlled by Jews, we Christians have actually gotten the better end of the deal. So you're asking the question, why should we support Israel? We want the Bible to be proven true. The archaeological evidence is found in Israel. The places where the Muslims can control it completely, like Bethlehem, we are not able to visit those holy sites. I have a theological belief, but I also have a belief that protecting the historical integrity of the Bible is good for all of humanity. And under its current government, we're allowed to access those holy sites. I'm able to go to see where Jesus walked on the water. I'm able to go and see where Jesus rose from the dead. I'm able to see where Jesus was betrayed by Judas Iscariot. I'm able to see where Jesus preached the Mount of the Beatitudes. And I think that's worth defending. And I'm afraid that if it was under Muslim control, there is no such guarantees always that Western Christians are gained access to those holy sites.
Why is Israel so
important? Okay. My God.
That's a great argument, man. Bethlehem is not controlled by the Palestinians. The whole West Bank is occupied by the Israelis. I mean, there's differences in, like, if you're talking about Area B, for instance, where the PA maintains civil control, but it's controlled militarily by the Israelis. Area C is totally controlled by the IDF. I mean, it's just absurd to say these kinds of things. And really, the PA's security forces are trained by or backed by the United States and Britain. They're trained by them and supported by the Israelis. They're effectively contractors for the occupation. And that's one of the reasons why everybody hates all the Palestinians. They despise the PA because they're so feckless, and they can't. That's why there's more support for Hamas, because at least they resist the occupation and the mass murder carried out by the IDF. I mean, there's a lot of brave resistance groups in the West Bank that are fighting this latest expansion of the war there. And Hamas is saying they're going to get more and more involved. But, this dates back. I always think of like Operation Guardian of the Walls, which was provoked by those evictions in East Jerusalem in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. And when they were raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as they always do in April when Ramadan comes along, and they were beating the hell out of women, children. They were destroying, religious artifacts, religious sites, and firing off sound bombs and rubber bullets and just desecrating the whole place and beating up all these civilians. And so the Hamas fired some rockets in response. It didn't kill anybody. So then Israel launched a major strike in Gaza and killed dozens of people, including many from a single family. And then they launched a whole war there. But that was, I remember, Ramzi Baruch, who's the, resident Palestinian columnist at antiwar.com, wrote a piece at that point where he said, look, the Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Palestinians are united. And it's not necessarily they're united behind Hamas, but they will respond to each other's oppression. They're a nation. They're one people, these Muslims and Christians alike. He doesn't know what he's talking about. The Christians are abused just as much as the Muslims in the West Bank. And they've done, horrible things. The Christian neighborhoods have suffered just as much as anybody else during what they've done to the Palestinian economy in the West Bank since this war started. They're bombing churches in Gaza. They're sniping Christian women in churches for fun. And the Pope had to come out and condemn that as terrorism. It's in this new report on at Responsible Statecraft this week, or last week, I should say, about how many aid workers that Israel is killing. The vast majority of aid workers that are killed globally, and not just from the UN, but from any humanitarian group, are killed by the Israelis. They talk about the story where they were attacking this church compound. And they sniped a woman. They killed one woman, and another Christian woman picked her up in the church compound and was carrying her away, attempting to get her to safety. And they killed her too, as she was carrying her. So that's what the Israeli apartheid army represents, is mass murdering Christians and Muslims and destroying their holy sites, destroying their education system, destroying their cemeteries, and wiping any memory of them, any physical tactile memory of them off the map. It is textbook genocide.
I was just about to say that. And that's what we always heard about. And my friend Ben Weir, who I like, he's all whole hog on Lily Tang Williams saying she's going to be the next Thomas Massie, but she called for sanctions against China for their treatment of the Uyghurs, which every person I've spoke to that lives in China, they live or have lived in China, had told me there is no genocide going on. When I had Jason, I think his name is, he goes by something else on Twitter. The title episode was called "What's China Really Like?" He had said that he went to Xinjiang and like to verify, because he heard about all these wild claims. He's like, "No, this is a very culturally rich area. The people there were very kind. They were definitely different, but he's like, it was a very, very like nice and culturally rich area, and there was no plausible way that there was being any kind of genocide taken out." But now, when we move over to Israel and Gaza, they're literally, like you said, destroying their entire way of life. They've killed, if we're just going by the Hamas numbers, right? 42,000 people and like 18,000, or 20,000 of those people being children. I've heard other people say estimates as high as like 200,000 people by the time this is all done, and that's probably factoring in people dead, buried under the rubble, starvation,
disease. They're spreading polio, exactly, and TB and other diseases.
To what you said, It literally is a genocide when you were eliminating every single source of their culture, their way of life, their ability to educate themselves, and their ability to maintain any kind of life. That is, by definition, a genocide. So people, and, you know, people can try to dodge around that, but I don't know what else you would call bombing churches, hospitals, schools, maternity wards, cancer wards. There are no operational hospitals over there anymore in some parts of the Gaza Strip. So, I mean, what is genocide if not that?
Yeah, and they're destroying all the universe. There's a great piece in Truth Out about their attacks on the education system. I think they've killed 750 educational workers alone, destroyed all the universities, which means all their libraries. And any of the most of the schools, as you know, every time they bomb a school, you read the article and you know what comes next. Well, it's been converted into a shelter for displaced people. And that's why they're bombing schools again. Now, they're bombing it to wipe their history off the map and their and destroy their heritage and their memory. But they're also bombing them because now they're shelters. And that's what Israel does. That's one of the reasons why, you know, it was commonly cited by Osama bin Laden in Operation Grapes of Wrath in their invasion of southern Lebanon in 1996. They bombed the first Khan massacre. They bombed a UN shelter and killed over 100 civilians, mostly women and children. And this is on a grand scale what they're doing now. So again, like that's why I expect more terrorism against the United States in response. And so, you know, to get back to like Charlie, I think I have Charlie muted. Is Charlie an America First guy ostensibly?
Yeah, he's part. This is kind of the frustrating part when you talk to anybody on ostensibly on the right, if you will. They'll rant and rave against Conservative Inc., but like the overlap here is almost like a Venn diagram. Like, and my favorite right wingers are the guys from the Old Glory Club, right? Pete Quinones, Red Hawk. I love these guys. I disagree with them about how much they love Trump, but I understand this is your guy. You know, you think he's going to own the shit libs and, you know, JD Vance, the PayPal mafia surrogate. Okay, whatever. I respect it, disagree, whatever. They attack Charlie Kirk and Conservative Inc., but it's like you realize these guys are like the loudest and biggest pushers for Trump at this point. Like you guys' overlap at this point is like a circle. And everybody that's worried about, you know, CBDCs and all these wild conspiracy theories, which probably are true, you think Trump, whose entire campaign has been we're going to make Israel great again and saying that we're going to clamp down on anti-Semitism, you know who's going to be first on that chopping block of cancel culture and digital IDs and social credit scores? It's going to be guys like us. It's going to be people who have any questions about Israel because, once again, who's some of Trump's biggest donors? The Adelson family. And this isn't some fucking crazy JQ conspiracy. This is just the fact of the matter is that Trump is mostly bought off and paid for by Big Pharma, the military industrial complex and the fucking Adelson family. And I chalked it up to like, this election is basically like the Department of Justice, woke corporations and the FBI versus the CIA, the Mossad and, anti-China think tanks. And also, big tech. That's pretty much what we're dealing with. And it's so funny because I even hear people in our circle say that like, oh, the CIA is rooting against Trump or something like that. I'm like, all his lackeys are like fucking CIA kooks, fucking Tucker Carlson, Joe Kent, Eric Prince, Peter Thiel. All these guys have ties to the CIA. So what do you mean? Like Trump's entire, you know, first bench is all fucking CIA lackeys. So really his old fucking, the Trump establishment now. Yeah. They're all fucking CIA guys. It's literally like the DOJ versus the fucking CIA. That's your choice, man.
Well, certainly there's a faction, the CIA, that led Russia to get everything. But I listen, man, what you're saying, the interesting thing about it, did you see one of the most interesting things about it is what you said about the FBI? Because did you see that clip recently, man, about with Trump saying that the FBI told him and he believes it, this is real, Iran is hacking my campaign and giving information to the Harris campaign and they're trying to kill me? Iran is trying to kill fucking Trump. And that's the thing he's going with. So instead of calling out the Secret Service, instead of, you know, coming up with some conspiracy theories about, and there's a lot of legitimate questions to ask about what the hell happened in Pennsylvania, let alone Ryan Ruth and his role in recruiting for the International Legion in Ukraine. But And how was he able to afford all that?
Look at this stud.
What's up? Hey, what's up, Pat? How you doing?
How's it going?
Doing pretty well.
I just
We're talking about the FBI telling Trump that Iran's trying to kill him, and they're hacking his election campaign, and they're giving information to Harris. And we have our 4 years of Iran gate to look forward to. And the FBI, there's a faction there at least that's trying to get on Trump's good side. It's working.
Well, how convenient.
Yeah.
No, you forget that it's all the entire establishment against Trump. There are no factions in our government that are rooting for Trump to win. That's what we're told.
I have a theory that they secretly love him, man, because he's the greatest thing that ever happened for the Uniparty and the Democrats.
I agree. Pat, are you drinking a beer on your back porch?
Oh, yeah. I'm having a good night tonight.
I see that shit grin fucking ear to ear.
Well, I had a stretch of like a month where I had either court or like a meeting or preparing for trial. So I'm just like, this week was the first week in a month where I had a couple like days that weren't slammed. So it was really nice.
Nice, man. Nice. Well, good to hear. I'm glad you could drop by. Misty was supposed to drop by, but I think she ultimately had something to do. It's good to see you. And, I'm guessing you have a better night than when we went out to a Korean barbecue.
That was so disappointing, dude.
Yeah.
Is this in Liberty and Health, or is this something else?
I don't know. We're just doing an episode of the podcast, but we could wrap it here and then we could shoot the shit for a little bit off air if you guys like. I'm thinking of probably wrapping now anyways.
Yeah.
We were talking about the Join the Resistance rally and the LP strategy of supporting Donald Trump. And
yeah, you know what, Pat, if you want to give your thoughts on that, go ahead. And then maybe Connor, you could shoot the shit about it for a few minutes and then we'll wrap there and we could shoot the shit off air.
Well, so the Join the Resistance rally is that like, so I haven't been keeping up as well as I should.
Charlie Kirk is one of the lead speakers, along with Brett Weinstein and a bunch of other Zionists. Oh, Jordan Peterson speaking. And basically, it is your moral duty to vote against the Democrats, Pat.
Bobby Kennedy Jr., Tulsi Gabbard. You know, one of my favorite things is the mural they did of the Washington Cross in the Delaware, where Donald Trump is in place of, Lady Liberty, who I think is Angela, is in there. And then you've got Donald Trump, Elon Musk. By the way, Jimmy Dore is speaking there as well.
Okay.
But, you know, Matt Taibbi.
Yeah. All right.
So there's some good people that are going to be there, but it's a de facto Trump rally.
Look, I like Jimmy Dore somewhat, but he did say when he was on RBN that, oh, Trump wants to be friends with China. I'm like,
wait, who said that? Jimmy Dore?
Jimmy Dore said that.
Okay. Yeah.
He is more likely to talk with, I will say this, Donald Trump is not a pussy Democrat in the sense that he will talk to Putin. He will talk to Xi. He will talk, hopefully he should talk to the Ayatollah. He should re-engage with Kim. Biden's been horrible on North Korea this entire time.
Yes.
And done unprecedented things, you know, bringing back nuclear armed submarines and so forth and carrying out the largest drills in years right on their border, rehearsing regime change war. And so he has a great opportunity to fix that. And if anybody can go to, you know, if Nixon can go to China, Trump can go to Tehran and make a deal. I have no confidence that he will. However, he is not, like I said, a pussy like Tony Blinken. I think that even Mike Pompeo would have talked to Lavrov multiple times publicly and on the phone. And because they're not, like I said, they're mass murdering scum. Tony Blinken is basically like a liberal analog of Mike Pompeo in a lot of ways. But Blinken is such a effeminate weakling. He's happy to just massacre people at will and starve them to death, but he doesn't like talking to a man like Sergey Lavrov. And I can understand because Blinken's he's really a nitwit and doesn't really know what he's doing. And he's way over his head. I mean, he's the one who's trying to get the green light for those strikes deep inside Russia, just like he did earlier in May when he was the one leading the charge to allow Ukraine to launch missile strikes into the border regions of Russia.
His thing, right, is like, my thing with Blinken is that if you look in his eyes, they're truly black.
Yeah.
You know, they really look at a picture of them, bring up like a high resolution picture of him, and his eyes are black like a freaking demon. So,
yeah. Oh my God.
It really is, dude.
Wow.
So, I mean, I know that's not as nuanced as Connor's analysis of it, but yeah, I don't know.
I just called him a pussy.
Well, oh a demon God. Pussy.
Okay, yeah. Hold on. I can't believe how right. I thought you were just kind of joking about
no.
it.
No, that's real.
It's actually right. Every single one,
he has dead black eyes.
Holy shit.
He was Joe Biden's right-hand man when he was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and they lied us into the Iraq war and with the opposition party held Senate.
Oh, my God.
He's responsible for the Iraq war. He's killed millions of people. He was an architect of the war in Libya, an architect of the war in Syria, an architect of the Ukraine war, an architect of the genocide in Gaza and Palestine. He's a sick, sick person.
Well, I mean, so what, Connor, what is your consensus on the Restore the Republic rally? Like, I mean, is it even as good as, well, you know, the anti-war, the nascent anti-war right at its best? Is it even that good?
I hope that Jimmy Dore and Matt Taibbi, you know, I assume that they will do a great job. I thought Jimmy Dore did a great job in the rally, the previous one that they held in D.C. I think Taibbi, I mean, I'm such a big fan of him. You know, Russell Brand is going to be there. Hopefully he says some good things about the war in Ukraine.
You know, my problem with Russell Brand is that he's basically completely shilled himself out to be a MAGA influencer.
Yeah. I mean,
glowing endorsements and rolling out the red carpet for all, for Marjorie Taylor Greene, fucking Ron DeSantis and all these fucking Zionists. And then he's doing this real weird public religious conversion when he was like some atheist communist for the longest time. Like, it's so fucking performative. And he's just become like this transparent fucking grifter. I understand they're trying to work with the right, and I'm okay with that. But when it comes to Israel and people who are saying that we should fund Israel and that what Israel is doing is right, at a certain point, I think we got to say, like, these people are actively working against one of the core tenets of libertarianism, which is non-interventionism and pro-peace. And that's exactly what these people do not represent. So I understand you want to make inroads with some people, but what are we doing if we're not calling these people out who are fervent, bought and paid for Zionists, where fucking Charlie Kirk has just gone on a nonstop fucking like an RFK style, give a rabbi a hand job tour ever since he questioned what happened on October 7th.
I mean, I guess I would say that in the priority of wars to oppose right now, I think that the genocide in Palestine should be number one, because the war in Ukraine, like as bad as it is and with the potential to escalate that exists, it has boiled for 2 years and it hasn't kicked off into something major. Now, I understand that, you know, approving these missile strikes deep in Russian territory is a big escalation. But I think, if anything, we've underestimated the ability of the West to escalate and the ability of Russia to just kind of deal with it. But at the point in time that we're at, I mean, with the escalations, with the pager detonations and all of that stuff, and then, you know, Israel looks like they're preparing to invade Lebanon, I would say that should be the priority right now, because that is about to really kick off. And I think it has a more realistic chance to escalate in the near future. Mm-hmm. But I would think that would be more important.
I'm with you. I mean,
it's more clear cut.
Yeah, I think that the risks of war with Iran, Hezbollah, the re-escalation of the wars in Yemen and Syria, which are going to be concomitant. I think they're carrying out, they're moving the genocide of the West Bank. That's the second most important front of the war. And that was before the pager attacks and the walkie-talkie attacks, where now they're saying Lebanon is the new theater, which we knew was coming. But to be honest, man, Putin has made clear, and they haven't approved those strikes, at least not publicly yet. I know the British, at least some reports said that they already did, but they really do need the Americans to give them the approval as well, apparently. And so, I mean, because, you know, they're basically a vassal state. But the risks of nuclear war are not confined to Eastern Europe and the Asia Pacific. Really, I think that if anybody's likely to use nukes at this point, it's going to be Netanyahu.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very concerned about that. And so in other words, I'm hoping for the best with this rally. I was a real critic and have been and still am of Evangelist strategy, of the rally itself, the Trump rally, this massive thing happening after the anti-war rally that thankfully Scott and Keith will be speaking out. I've already heard Keith's speech, by the way, and it's amazing. Everybody should see that when it comes out. It's going to be, I bet it's going to be the best speech of the whole thing. I mean, it's just, I don't see how it could be so good. You know, I mean, it is an effective Trump rally. And I raised some questions to Angela online about the funding and why, because apparently they have Trump donors that are putting money into the thing. And, but if you go to the donor page, it's like they're asking for $500,000 for it. And they've only raised like, it's like 70,000 or something like that. So I'm like, where is that money gone? And where, how are you going to put it on? Because they did cancel an anti-war rally last year because they didn't have funding. I mean, I remember getting the call that it had been canceled, and I look at the page and I go, wait, you needed money to put this on? You know, because they were short like more than $100,000 to get the thing going. And they were telling people, go ahead and make your arrangements now. And I felt like that was just a lousy way to handle the thing. I mean, I do think if you go to the website, it's very hard to say that it isn't a Trump rally. So hopefully we do get some dissenting voices in there. Not necessarily that they have to make a big stink about Trump, but that, yes, like Pat's saying, they should highlight the war on the Palestinians and why that absolutely needs to be stopped. And the U.S. should, you know, I don't know if they want to advocate an arms embargo or if they want to advocate ending all aid to Israel or just conditioning aid to Israel in order to force a ceasefire. But, you know, they've got to do something. But overall, it just seems to me to be part of this larger kind of disaster we've watched, where the Libertarian Party has been converted into an ancillary of the Trump campaign. I mean, I don't like Chase Oliver. I don't even really know much about him, except some of the things I've heard that I like and a lot of the things I've heard that I don't like, and I don't pay attention to him. And he kind of disappeared. Mike Termont, every once in a while, I'll see a tweet where he's asking an AI program what his policy should be, like on Iran or something. And I'm just like, this is too fucking stupid for me to even know about. So I understand like saying this is a bust. But at the same time, if you're subverting the national candidate of the party that you're chairing in order to promote the GOP candidate and then saying like things like, tell your progressive friends to vote for Chase Oliver because he'll end the war in Gaza, wink, wink, when there's no... there's not even a fantasy that Trump could do that. And, you know, and I've heard her say recently that if in this thing where they have these inroads with the Trump campaign, apparently, and they want to get a libertarian in the cabinet, you know, Corey DeAngelis or somebody to head the education department, the idea that they're going to pull that off, I think is kind of ridiculous. If you have a guy whose policy, and I like Corey a lot, but if what she's saying that they're going to put somebody in there who wants to abolish the Department of Education, good luck getting that past the Senate confirmation.
Right.
There's no fucking way that can happen. The best we can hope for is that there's some negotiations with Pyongyang. I think that there's a real chance where you can do that given the past history. Hopefully Bolton won't be in the administration again. But Kyle, like you were asking earlier about the, you know, how much worse can it get than Blinken? Well, I posed that question to Scott, you know, not too long ago, because there was this article that came out where they were talking about, you know, Politico is saying that like the hawks in the Republican Party, we want Pompeo to run the Pentagon, we want Cotton at the State Department to replace Blinken. And I said, you know, I don't know how much worse it can get than Blinken, man. And he just goes, oh, it can get a lot worse if Tom Cotton is Secretary of State.
Yeah. Someone who is competent and evil.
Yeah.
Right.
So, hey, I promised my wife we would watch a horror movie tonight because we're on a horror movie kick. So I got to get going. She's in the bedroom waiting. But okay, I wanted to say hi.
No, cool, Pat. Well, I'm glad you could join. Hey, by the way, Tommy literally just texted me and asked why you didn't email him back.
Who, me?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, Tommy Salmon said, why didn't Pat email me back?
Well, fuck, I didn't even... Oh, because I changed my email address.
Okay, well, shoot Tommy an email.
Okay, I will. I will.
Pat, okay. Good to see you, brother. Well, I think we'll go ahead and wrap here. Pat, give your plugs, and then you can rock and roll, Connor. After Pat. Pat, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Hey, vitaldissent.com and libertarianinstitute.org. I've been so busy, I got to get my shit together.
You're good, man. Anyways, Pat, good to see you, brother. And hopefully we get to hang out again sometime soon, man. It was
Definitely. Definitely. All right. Love you guys. Take care.
Love you too, man.
Take care. Peace.
So my plugs, Libertarian Institute, I'm assistant editor there. Watch Conflicts of Interest. We got 4 episodes coming out every week. Kyle just had his baby. So he's taking a little bit of time off. And then we're starting the show up again next week. So I have a lot more shows coming out for you. LibertarianInstitute.org. I got an article I'm very excited about that'll be running in the featured section on next week. Check us out. You know, you'll see articles in the news section at antiwar.com and often in the viewpoints. And I do news and other work for antiwar.com as well. That's it. I'm on Twitter at Freeman's Mind 96, and I've lately been doing a lot more than retweeting with that account. So I'm kind of on a mission to oppose the pro-Trump shit that I keep seeing in my feeds. So if you want more entertainment on that level, you can check it out. I'm a equal opportunity hater of both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. The only reason I do a little bit more criticism of Trump is because I see too many anti-war libertarians or anti-war people, even on the left, sometimes making excuses for him. And I think it's just dangerous. But anyway, this has been awesome, Kyle. I love you, man. And we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, for sure. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care.
Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast, so why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.